So I want to thank Gabi, Andy, and Antoine for getting me out of Chicago for a week in February. Yeah, it's going to be tough to go back tomorrow. So, yeah. So actually, I'm not the person who opened this new frontier. It's really Hiday, and he's going to tell you about all his wonderful experimental data. So, but you'll have to stick around for the last talk to hear it. I actually went a little fast there. So there was a little nice little article that Patrick Lee did for Science. And as we know, there's this little object called the quantum spin liquid, this exotic beast, like the griffin that we've been looking for a long time. As he said in this article, there are sort of three of these promising candidates that have come up. So what I mean by spin liquid are insulators that have large Curie-Weiss temperatures but don't show order or signs of spin glass behavior. So what's after these things, this is organic, this is something called Herbert Smithite, and this is the one else I'll be concentrating on here, and this shows the lattice of ions. So the magnetic ions sit on a triangular lattice here, Kagame and hyperKagame. And there's also a nice little article that Barbara did for Physics Today here about a couple years ago. So just to remind you that all this interest in spin liquids really goes back to some seminal work that Phil Anderson did. You know, you sort of think about an ordinary nail lattice case. I have up and down spins on the lattice, but he said, well, what happens if I instead just have a liquid of spin singlets instead? And this was his original proposal for what was going on in high TC materials. Of course, what happened was a few months later, the experimentalists discovered actually that the cuprates are actually a Nell anti-ferromagnet. But he was right in the sense that it only takes a few percent of holes to get rid of the Nell magnetic state. So it's almost a spin liquid. In the original proposal, it was a uniform spin liquid state, and that's interesting because there's a novel prediction that, in fact, the S equal 1/2 excitations would actually possess a zero energy surface just like a Fermi surface. So why would you think about singlets? And the reason is the following. A Nell state only gains you, if you have an exchange energy between sites J, a Nell state only gains you J over 4 per bond. But with a singlet, you get this extra quantum mechanical factor SS plus 1, and so you actually gain, for the spin 1/2 case, you actually gain 3J over 4 per bond. So you might think that for low spin systems, spin 1/2 systems, which is like what the cuprates are, especially at low dimensionality where fluctuations play an important role, that the energy could be such that singlets could be stabilized over the standard Nell lattice state. Now, this actually goes back to earlier work in 1973 because there's even a better way to get it realized, and that's actually to frustrate the Nell magnetic order. And the easiest way to do that, for instance, is a triangular lattice. Here's a standard triangular lattice. We have up and down spins, and then this guy doesn't know what to do. So the system has to compromise classically by putting the spins at 120 degree angles. But of course, once I do this, I lose, you no longer get J over 4 per bond. You get less because of the canting angle of the spins. So this brings up to case number one. This is organic material. It was actually discovered at argon, believe it or not, because they were looking for superconductors, and in fact, this one under pressure becomes a superconductor. But this work was done by Kanoda's group, and they noticed this. You have a bunch of dimers, organic dimers with a net spin 1/2 per dimer, which sort of sits on a distorted triangular lattice, and you can see the susceptibility. It has this classic behavior like you see in cuprates at high temperatures like this, and then it rolls over and comes down. Yeah. So it looks, you know, sort of like what you expect for singlet type formation. And then if you look at the specific heat, a lot of these things, if you look at the specific heat, C over T versus temperature, then it looks like it's extrapolating to zero, real insulator. But in this case, this one extrapolates to a finite value. So even though it's a charge insulator, C over T is a constant at low temperatures. And you can see that this thing doesn't have much field dependence. You crank the field up to 1.48 tesla, it stays pretty much fixed. Again, it's sort of an indication that singlet excitations are what's going on. In the phase diagram here, the speculation is a mod insulator. The speculation is a spin liquid, and then if you pressurize it, you either go into a Fermi liquid phase at higher temperatures or into a superconductor at lower temperatures. Okay, well, there's a problem with this material, as pointed out by some colleagues of mine. If you look at the thermal expansion at about 6 Kelvin, there's a really whopping big peak in the thermal expansion. So some kind of ordering phenomena is going on at 6 Kelvin, and the nature of this ordering phenomena hasn't been elucidated yet, but that indicates that, in fact, there is probably the low-temperature ground state probably has some kind of ordering. So then we go to Herbert Smithite. So this stuff was actually discovered in some cave in Chile somewhere. It was named after Herbert Smith. I don't think he was a discoverer. I think he was the one that first identified the crystal structure of it. And it's really a beautiful thing, but the natural stuff is a bit crappy to deal with. So Nasera's group at MIT spent a long time actually trying to make it synthetically, and they did. And so the nice thing about this case is a copper ion sit on a Kagame lattice. So here's a Kagame, this is, you know, Japanese basket weaving. And the thing about a Kagame is that you have corner sharing triangles. So it turns out it's more frustrated than the ordinary triangular lattice. An interesting thing is that Curie-Weiss temperature is quite high, over 300 Kelvin, and yet again, this system doesn't show any evidence of magnetic order all the way down to low temperatures. Again, just like with the other guy, if you look at C over, this is specific heat versus temperature, you can see a pretty linear slope down here, indicating again that despite the fact that the system is insulating, it has low energy spin excitations, which are essentially linear in temperature. And the speculation is, as you dope zinc, this has zinc in it, and you can go all the way from zero zinc concentration to one. This is the material that we were discussing here in these graphs. And there's speculation that, yeah, it's nail ordered here, but maybe this is a valence bond solid up here, which means that the singlets would order in some kind of crystalline lattice. And maybe this is the famous RVB spin liquid sitting out here. Now, there's a problem with this system, and that is that if you look at M over H, there's a low temperature upturn in the susceptibility. And this is thought to be due to the fact, as was mentioned in the talk on the manganese copper O4, there's a tendency for the copper and zincs to interchange on the lattice. And so the feeling is that there's about 6% interchanging going on here, and so the system has a lot of impurities. And you can see this effect is strongly field dependent. So the feeling is that maybe there's a lot of dirt in the system. Although I should say, a couple days ago, this was challenged, and the group from MIT have shown that, in fact, the low temperature upturn can simply be explained based on omega over T scaling. So this is a omega over T scaling plot for neutron and AC susceptibility data over a large range of omega over T's, four decades, and they see a nice scaling plot that looks very similar to what people have inferred in heavy fermion quantum critical systems. So they're arguing now this low temperature upturn may actually be intrinsic and have to do with omega over T scaling, as if you're near a quantum critical point. Yep. Yeah, so that's a good point. So the upturn that's seen in these kind of measurements, and this is a combination of AC susceptibility data and inelastic neutron scattering data, does not show up in the NMR night shift. And that was original thinking about why all this was an impurity effect. Yeah. So again, like I said, this was a murky thing. Now let me say a little bit about the Kagame case, which is sort of interesting. Like I said, it's more frustrated than the triangular lattice. And one way to visualize this is, let me take these outer spins and have them fixed, and now let me rotate the inner spins around this hexagon relative to the outer spins. And you can show that you still stay in the same classical ground state when you do this. And so this indicates that, in fact, there's lots of low energy degrees of freedom present in this lattice that's not present in the triangular lattice. And there's been a lot of studies. Classically, there have been several proposed states. You have these little triangles, so you have three spins. And remember, again, this 120 degree orientation for the classical ground state. This proposal that you have a Q equal to zero ordering parameter, you can have a staggered thing that goes, has a square root three structure. This has been proposed. But the other proposal is, in fact, that you have singlets which order on a lattice. And this is a valence bond ground state that was proposed by David Singh and Rajiv Hughes. Rajiv Singh and David Hughes, my gosh. Don't tell them. Maybe they may be listening. I'm already in trouble, you know, so. So the ideal here is you have these perfect hexagons, and look at these hexagons. You have singlet bonds, and they can resonate. So this is almost like benzene, sort of like the original ideal that Phil had about RBB anyway, sort of ideally realizing these hexagons. And then you have these weird things called pinwheels where the singlets can sort of rotate around. And you get a chiral effect because you can rotate the pinwheels can either be like this, or you can go this way instead where the pink dots are at. There's been some recent evidence that this might be the case. These are what's called multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. It's an attempt to generalize DMRG to multiple dimensions higher than one. And they've done these simulations, and they get something that looks very much like the Singh-Hughes state. So that's been one thing. And there's been a new kind of expansion method in terms of loops that's been done by Didier Poblanc. This, again, came out of the web very recently. And the speculation is, in fact, in their simulations, they also find the valence bond ground state, but it's very, very close by to the spin liquid state. So this is a famous Rockshore-Kibbleson point up here, and they get this by sort of varying some phenomenological parameter in their Hamiltonian. This would be the Heisenberg limit that we've been talking about. So the ideal is that, yeah, they think also it's probably a valence bond crystal, but they're very, very close to quantum critical point where you would melt into a true spin liquid state. Now, exact diagonalizations have been done, and you can really see the difference between a Kagame lattice and a square and even a triangular lattice. These were done by Claire Louie's group. And this is on 36 site lattices, and this is each spin sector. So this is spin 0 sector, spin 1, spin 2. And you can see in the square case, you just have this one low energy branch that's pulled off the rest of them. And this is just the spin waves of the Knell antiferromagnet. And you see something more or less the same in the triangular case as well. There's two of these guys there because you've got a bipart, you know, there's two atoms you can think about in the triangular case in a unit cell. So, but it's still the same thing. You sort of have this low energy magnon branch. You get the Kagame, it's just totally different. You just have a whole range of states starting at the ground state energy going all the way up, and it's completely dense. And if you think about the thermodynamic limit, you know, there's an exponential increase in the number of these states as you go to the thermodynamic limit. And then there's a gap to the spin 1 states, but they're not sure in the thermodynamic limit whether this gap would actually survive or not. So whether the system has a spin gap or not is not known actually at the moment from exact diagonalization studies. And you say, well, just do the next biggest lattice. And as was pointed out in this recent workshop, actually the supercomputers we have right now, we can't do a 48-site lattice. At least with the current ones. So maybe with future ones or whether improvement in the Lanchos methodology, we might be able to get there, but right now we can't get there. In fact, we've been stuck at 36 for quite some time now. Okay, so this brings me to our friend sodium iridate. So here, this is a very interesting material because unlike the other ones, it's actually a 3D material. In fact, the space group is cubic for this material. It's a pyrochlore lattice. This was, of course, Okamoto et al. Really, this is actually Hide's group, and I guess he may talk a bit about this in his own talk. It's a pyrochlore lattice where you replace one of the guys in the tetrahedron by a sodium atom. And so instead of having corner-sharing tetrahedron, you end up with corner-sharing triangles, just like you do with a Kagame lattice, but this is now pulled up in a three-dimensional space. And there are consequences about this I'll go into in a minute. Because when you do this pulling procedure, it turns out the lattice doesn't have inversion symmetry. So there's two isomorphs, four-fold rotation axis, either one-quarter or three-quarters. Again, if you look at this, you have power law behavior in the specific heat at low temperatures, indicating low energy excitations, yet the material is actually an insulator. Again, the susceptibility looks, this is inverse susceptibility, looks a little flat. This little downturn here, again, is not seen by NMR, so it's thought maybe it's extrinsic due to the fact that the sodium atoms are not completely ordered in this lattice. Look at the Curie-Weiss temperature, absolutely enormous, almost 700 Kelvin. The effective moment from the high temperature fit is 2 Bohr magnetons, and yet the system does not magnetically order. That's minus 650, so yeah. The Knell, it's a Knell state. I mean, it would be a Knell state if it ordered. So these are resistivity versus temperature. This is, most of the data on this material is surprisingly unpublished. I don't know what the story is there today, but it'd be nice to get some of this out in the literature at some point. This is resistivity versus temperature. This is a log scale here, okay? So it really have activated behavior in the resistivity. As you pressurize it, it comes down, very reminiscent of what happens in the organic superconductor case. But at low temperatures, they always seem to have an upturn. But what he tells me now is that they've been able to finally get it into the semi-metallic phase. And we'll, I guess hopefully you'll hear about these results later in the session. Now, there's a whole variety of these materials that have been done. Most of these have been studied by Hiday's group. Strontium-2-iridium-04 is a lanthanum cuprate analog. And you can see, here's the optical conductivity versus photon energy. You see a nice gap, and there's a peak. In cuprate case, this would sit about 2 volts, but in this case, it sits at about 0.5 volt. You can make the cubic analog, which is metallic. So the cubic strontium-iridium-03 analog is metallic. This is like a bilayer ruthenate. It's somewhere in between. These are phonon modes, of course. And then this one really looks insulating-like, the strontium-2-iridium-04. This has been studied a lot because it's much simpler. The sodium iridate I didn't tell you about, but there are like 4 formula units in the unit cell, so about 60 atoms, so it's a real nasty thing. This is like lanthanum cuprate, it's a simpler system. And what's going on in these systems is the following. Basically what you have is you have one hole in a T2G band, right? So this almost reminds you of like heavy fermion systems, like a ytterbium heavy fermion system where you would have one hole in the top of a band. The interesting thing, though, is that because of spin orbit, the T2G band splits into a quartet and a doublet. So you end up, in the end, because of spin orbit, with a half-filled doublet. So it's like cuprates, but it's caused by spin orbit coupling. You end up with a half-filled doublet. So that was what makes it interesting. And then you can imagine Mott Hubbardizing this thing and splitting this thing up and getting a small Mott Hubbard gap. And because these bands are so narrow, you only need a small value view to get this happening. In fact, the DMFT or LDA plus U calculations have been done on this system. You need a U of about 2 electron volts to reproduce the optical gap. Okay. Now, a lot of these systems have been thought about recently. I don't have time to talk about this one. Another very interesting system, sodium-2-iridium-03, where the iridium sit on a honeycomb lattice. And Xushun Zhang's group has proposed that this system might actually exhibit a quantum spin Hall effect. But I don't know whether Hiday is going to say anything about this system or not. So let me get back to the sodium-4-iridium-308. You have a lattice of corner-sharing triangles, but they're pulled up into three-dimensional space. Again, the semi-classical ground state would have the spins at 120-degree angles. The interesting thing is, if you remember in the Kagame, you had these hexagons which you could rotate around, and that was what was causing more frustration than the triangular lattice. In this case, the loops are longer. They're tensite. So the hyper-Kagame lattice is even more frustrated than the Kagame case. And so there have been all sorts of proposals about what might be going on here. There have been various RBB proposals, including one that, in fact, maybe this system actually has a spin liquid ground state, which is a uniform RBB state, and therefore the low energy spin excitations might actually form a Fermi surface. Okay, now Leon and his graduate student Geng Chen, who may be here, did an extensive study of this material. A very, very nice paper that took us a long time to read through and thoroughly understand. The problem, of course, is spin orbit comes into play. And because of spin orbit, there's a tendency to lock the spin to the lattice and get you away from an isotropic Heisenberg model. And this of course, what that means, if this is really what happens, then the system should be magnetically ordered. And in fact, what they were showing here is not only you have, so here are the triangles, corner-sharing triangles, and then here are the three components of the Zhalozhensky-Maria interaction that are expected based on this kind of geometry. And looking at this, there's all sorts of proposed ground state. Here's a collinear ground state that they propose. Here's an alternate, which people call the windmill state. But the conclusion they had is that if anisotropy is present, then you really should end up with a magnetically ordered ground state. So this is where we came in. hate to say, these are just LDA, no DMFT or LDA plus U here, but you have to understand it's a pretty nasty material, right? So you have to start somewhere. These are about 60 atoms per unit cell. The electronic structure of this thing is you have a bunch of oxygen states down here, and then you have a very narrow band of T2G states here. This is without spin orbit coupling. Here are the EG states, and these are sodium. So in fact, despite the fact you have this half-filled doublet that looks like cuprates, in fact, the electronic structure to me is more reminiscent of manganese. This is because the oxygen states are energetically separated from the transition metal states. And maybe this has something to do with the difference between nickel 1+ and copper 2+ that we were discussing earlier during the meeting. Now, the effective spin orbit is exactly what these simple models predict. This is a blow-up in energy around the Fermi energy, and now I turn on spin orbit. This T2G band splits into a nice quartet, a nice doublet, and the Fermi energy sits right here in the middle. So again, you have a half-filled doublet from the T2G states. And this is a spaghetti. This is a band structure. Fortunately, it's a simple cubic zone. You get a quartet of states, a doublet of states half-filled, and here's a Fermi surface if the thing had turned out to be a metal. This is a tight binding fit. And when I say this, actually 6 months of work went into that one sentence. We worked a long, long time trying to get a tight binding fit to this lattice. Very difficult because of the very, very low site symmetry in this particular lattice. But I thought we did a pretty reasonable job in the end. This is a blow-up of this actually, but despite the fact that we're trying to fit the entire bandwidth, all the bands, not just some of them, all of them, it's pretty amazing that the Fermi surface came out as well as it did. Now, the first interesting thing about this lattice is the following. The octahedron are very distorted in this lattice, so each octahedron actually has just a C2 axis present. Despite this, the direct exchange interaction between the inner iridians is completely isotropic. Even with the octahedron distorted, I think this is a rather amazing result. And in fact, it turns out there's a very simple form for the direct exchange based on sigma pi and delta Hopping integrals for DD. I thought for sure this would be changed as soon as we put the anisotropy in, but it stays the same. Unfortunately, there's super exchange present, which should give rise to anisotropic exchange with Jalzinski-Maria. And you can sort of understand this. Here's the super exchange pathway. Here are two octahedron. These are iridium sites in red. These are the octahedron. It's like cuprates. You have something analogous to apical oxygens. These are the brown guys. And then you have something analogous to planar oxygen. These are the blue guys. But they're very different. They're not related by inversion. They're related by the C2 axis. So rather than the brown guys being here and here, they're actually here and here. And now you see, if I go between two iridium sites, I go between two different oxygen sites. In the band structure calculation, those oxygen levels differ in energy by about 2 eV. So they're very, very different oxygens. So what happens in a lot of these iridium ions lattices, like the sodium-2-iridium-O3, is these two pathways actually cancel in the super exchange calculation. But that doesn't happen in this case because these oxygens are quite different. So the first time we did this, we were very depressed. These are the diagonal components of the exchange. In fact, there are off-diagonal components of the exchange, like SX, SY, again, because of the spin orbit, and plus the Jalzinski-Maria. But I'm just showing the diagonal components of the exchange as a function of U sub D. And so the good thing about this is that you get an exchange constant. This is experimental value. You get an exchange constant pretty much equal to experiment for a U sub D of around 1 volt or so. That's a nice thing. The bad thing is that you have an enormous anisotropy here because of the super exchange. Okay, so these are the SY and SZ components of the exchange, this is the SX component of the exchange for a particular set of iridium ions. So then we sat there and thought about it. Could we do a better thing on the tight binding? And what we did not take into account before is the fact that because of distortions of the octahedron, the T2G levels are actually split by residual crystal field splitting. So we attempted to take those things into account. Lo and behold, we ended up something pretty isotropic. For this particular set of tight binding parameters, what happened is miraculously the super exchange term became very small, and you were dominated by the direct exchange term. You can see the amount of anisotropy is pretty low, and the U sub D value that you need to get the experimental value is about 1.5 volts, which is pretty reasonable compared to what the LDA plus U simulations indicate on strontium-2 iridium-O4. So maybe this is it. Just for miraculous reasons, the super exchange terms just turn out to be small, and you're dominated by the direct exchange term, which, despite the presence of spin orbit, gives you, would really give you an isotropic Heisenberg model. So that may be what's going on, but we'll see. Okay, so let me end here with something more speculative. Imagine you had a spin on Fermi surface. How would you know? So we got this idea listening to a talk that Leon gave about 2 years ago. And he said, well, you know, if I have spin ons, maybe I have Fredel oscillations. So we started thinking about that. And if you remember how the computer's memory works in your computer, your hard drive works in your computer, you have two ferromagnetic things with something like chromium. This is like iron. This is like chromium in between. And you have oscillatory coupling between these guys. And this is due to the RKKY interaction. So we thought, well, let's just take this guy, chromium or whatever, and replace it by the spin liquid. And as you vary the thickness of this thing, if you have 2KF type coupling from the spin-on Fermi surface, then you should be able to get oscillatory coupling between these two ferromagnets. Of course, my experimental friends say I'm out of my mind. They took 20 years to perfect iron, chromium, iron, and now you're talking about doing iron, sodium, iridate, iron. But there's an advantage to the iridate, and you notice that you grow. Here's, you need a component of the spanning vector along this direction. So this is bad for 2D systems, right? Because you typically grow them like this, and therefore typically this is a C-axis. That would be very bad news. But the sodium iridate is cubic lattice, so you don't have this problem. And so here's a prediction. You know, here's a spin-on Fermi surface that the uniform RBB guys predict. And then basically we took into account spin orbit and used this old formalism to try to get some estimation of what the oscillatory coupling should look like as a function of separation of the thickness of the spin liquid spacer. So this is a possibility. I think as theorists we have to sort of start coming up with things, right? You know, we produce these exotic things, and then you have to tell experimentalists, you know, whether you could actually see this and how would you be able to see it. So this is just a speculation in the dark. So let me end with this slide. Cuprates are mod insulators characterized by half-filled band and a large J. So J is quite big in this system. It's around 30 millivolts, so it's quite large. So are iridates. So the ideal is if iridates can be doped, and maybe Hideo will tell us a little bit about this later on. And of course, the miraculous thing is this, it'd be great if they could be doped and become high-temperature superconductors. It'd be wonderful to have an iridium analog of high-temperature superconductors in a 3D space group. That would be sort of really neat. So let me end at this point. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mike, for managing to finish almost exactly on time, despite ignoring my sign. So we have time, 15 minutes for discussion.
May I ask, are these materials, in your opinion, truly molten insulators, or you think that they might, that insulator nature might be because of the magnetism? In other words, is it slatted like insulator or it's smooth like insulator? I mean, is it known from experiment? At least for some materials, we know that there is ordering at low temperature.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, they've gone. I don't know how low have you gone in temperature today? You guys don't see any magnetism, right?
Yeah, 300.
Huh? 300. So at least down to 300 millik, there's no magnetic ordering. Now, of course, we could just try to do a magnetic calculation to see what kind of, whether we could open up an exchange gap in the system, but with 60 atoms per unit cell, I mean you could do it, but it's, it requires someone more dedicated than me, maybe a postdoc slave or something. And you might say, why this stuff hasn't been looked at by neutron scattering? Well, the problem is iridium is a well-known absorber of neutrons, right? So this turns out to be a real problem. Although with X-rays it's possible, right? Nice high Z element. Should be really nice to do by X-rays.
Yep.
Yep. So I sort of skimmed through things a little bit. One of the problems, right, is what happens in most systems is 2KF, if you Fourier transform, is comparable to layer separation. And because of surface roughness, you would, you know, you basically lose it. So what they actually see are long period oscillations in these measurements. In fact, they're like cone anomalies, but they're very weak. You never see them by neutron scattering, but you can detect them here. So the nice thing about these systems is that, you know, this calculation, the Fermi surface is actually pretty small. So in fact, this distance, if you Fourier transform, is much longer than the inner layer, than the lattice constant. In the sodium, in the other cases, the organic, the Fermi surfaces are very big, but then the umlaut vectors that connect you from one to the other is pretty small. In fact, that's what they actually see in iron, chromium, iron, typically, is the umlaut vectors from one large Fermi surface to the other.
Actually, just on this slide, the M star over M factor there is really something in the class, in the usual formula, is something like an impedance mismatch between the electron waves in one of the ferromagnets and the thing in your spacer layer.
Yeah.
So what's the impedance mismatch between an electron and a spin liquid thing?
Yeah, so all we did in the calculation was that, you know, we just basically said that J set the bandwidth. And we put in spin orbit corrections, but you're right. What happens is this is the earlier stuff that was done by the French group, you know, early on in the GMR field. What the sophisticated DFT guys do is they actually calculate the transmission barrier between the iron and the spin liquid and do it like really properly. And that really sounds like a nightmare of a calculation. So this happens, you know, in heavy fermions as well. You know, if you look at the Andreev tunneling peak in heavy fermions, it's suppressed, and this is thought to be due to the velocity mismatch between the thing that you're tunneling from and the heavy fermion. You may have similar mismatch going on here. I just don't have any.
Well, I guess my question, which really is just a theoretical exercise in pointy-headed intellectualism at this point, but what you have in between is not electron at all. It's a spin liquid.
Yeah, that's
so
exactly right.
So my question is, how do I think about the impedance mismatch between the spin-ons of a spin liquid, which are on one side of the interface, and the electrons on the other side?
Yeah.
Are there any other factors that go into the transmission? Did anybody think about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point. But I don't think it... I think that all you need is two... Okay, so what I know is it was a calculation that Lessig did, right? In the U1 spin liquid case, and he definitely got Fredel oscillations in the spin susceptibility. So that I think that part is okay, but this transmission barrier thing is, yeah, I know, it's a real issue. And of course, you wonder if you actually have an insulator on one side and metal on the other side, you know, what kind of, maybe you develop a Schottky barrier there, I don't know, right?
If you go back to your slide there, I would guess that it's very likely that this 1 over z squared dependence would be different. It's understood that these states have power law, Fredel-like oscillations, and spin density, which is presumably what you need, at least if you think of weakly coupling to the two ferromagnets. But the power law will not be the same as for a Fermi liquid.
This will be a challenging problem for a graduate student or postdoc, huh?
So is there a reason why you don't just say something simple as like heat capacity or thermal conductivity as evidence for a spin-on Fermi surface?
Okay, so this is a point. In the two materials, right, in the Herbert-Smithite and the organic, if you saw C over T was linear in T, right? So that's what you expect for a Fermi surface, and that's why it's speculation. On the other hand, depending on the dimensionality, you can also get magnons that behave that way. So you have to be very careful, right? Now, what I skimmed over is this unfortunate fact that in sodium iridate, it doesn't look like T, it looks like T squared. And so I skimmed over all of this. Some people say, well, you have a spin-on Fermi surface with a instability, like a pairing instability, and you actually develop line nodes on this surface, and then you get T squared instead. But my understanding, the experimental data on the low temperatures has changed a little bit lately. Yeah, okay. How much? 1 millijoule? Yeah.
Okay, I have probably a historical question. The first quantum liquid in physics was liquid helium, of course. And could you comment shortly what is different and what is similar between those quantum liquids and well-known case of liquid helium.
Yeah, so in these cases are charge insulators. That's really what I meant. The system is charge insulators, and high temperature you have a Curie-Weiss behavior and the susceptibility. So based on high temperature, you say, okay, it's an insulator, it's Curie-Weiss, it should magnetically order. And like I said, the mean field, in this case, in the iridate, the Curie-Weiss temperature is 700 Kelvin. So at mean field theory, you would actually have a magnet at 700 Kelvin. And that's the point. They've gone under, down to 300 millikelvin, they see no magnetic order. And this is not like what happens, you know, you don't have something like Curie-Weiss behavior at high temperatures in helium-3, for instance.
Okay, and could we learn something about excitations in this liquid spinons here and, well, how do you call it?
Well, this is exactly the interesting point, right? Yeah. Because I showed you the exact diagonalization spectrum for the Kagame. This is totally different than even a triangular lattice, right? And so, I mean, in some sense, you don't see collective modes, right? You just basically see a dense tower of states.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yep.
The spinomic splitting, if you do LDA, there was a similar problem a couple of years ago just in the roving, simple perovskite type structure, where it turned out, simple maybe, that the U, if you put U on, would enhance the spinomic splitting by a factor of 2, which is not unusual. I mean, in NASA, of course, we are negative spinomic splitting. But still, for a normal condensed matter system, which is also a
right. So my LDA calculation is actually Dirac. It solves a Dirac equation. Now that was my calculation. Now what did the LDA plus U guys do? I don't know if anyone knows. My feeling is that they did the spin orbit by a second variational step in the LDA plus U, but I'm not certain.
The other question would be, you show the Fermi circuits,
yep,
which is the one from Kardashev.
Yep.
And considering the fact that you had 60 mark atoms for the original atoms, but there were surprisingly few sheets on the Fermi circuit for us to do human cells. So are there some gaps or?
Right. So yeah. So what happens, of course, is the following. You have a doublet. And so there would be 24 bands. But in fact, if reversion symmetry was present, those bands would be Cramer's degenerate. So there would only be 12 of them. Okay. So the fact that 5 of the 12 cross is that's not too unexpected.
Yes, I understand that in these systems, as soon as you have some isotropic interactions, the system have an ordering.
Yep.
And here, apparently experimentally, there is no ordering.
Yep.
You show us that in calculation you find a large anisotropy in the interaction.
Well, so, this is the point. I'm embarrassed to say that the published paper that we had, which just came out, did this. And the reason we didn't do this one is because this is technical details. I'm not completely happy with this tight binding fit. There are certain aspects of the fit I'm not happy with. It has a lower RMS error because it has more fitting parameters. It has a lower RMS error, but the solution space is much more complicated. So why we didn't look at it very closely. But for this, the reason why is just turned out the direct exchange term, for whatever reason, turned out to be quite large in this lattice. That's really a bit of a surprise, but you can understand this is not like cuprates where you go copper, oxygen, copper. They're like 180 degree bonds. In this case, you have 90 degree bonds, copper, oxygen, copper. And there was a paper that Kalunin and those guys did showing that the 90-degree bond case is very, very different than the 180-degree bond case that we're used to in cuprates.
We have more questions? If not, let's thank Mike one more time. Let's take five.